Good day. Today is Friday, 21st November 2025, and before I proceed with this programme, let me make quickly two announcements. The first one is to remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched this programme, or whichever part of the programme you want to watch and listened to, you've liked what you've heard and you want to indicate that fact. The second announcement I'm going to make is that tomorrow I'm going to be travelling to Edinburgh to meet various people there. And by the way, much of my family is coming with me, my wife and my children. So I will be in Edinburgh. I will be returning to London late on Tuesday. That inevitably is going to affect the length of my programmes and my ability to do programmes. They might be appearing at unusual hours, and there is a distinct possibility that they might be shorter than usual, depending on the pressure of events that takes place over the course of the next 4 days. But I do intend, to the best of my ability, to continue to do programmes during this 4-day period. So you will still be hearing from me over that time. I apologise in advance if this is going to cause any inconvenience to anyone and if this is inevitably going to lead to some gaps in my coverage, but I will do my best over the next 4 days. With that, let's proceed with the programme. And today, again, I'm going to focus exclusively on the situations connected to the conflict in Ukraine. And the pace of events is accelerating and it is becoming more and more dramatic. Now, the last 24 hours have provided clarity both about the diplomacy that is coming out of the United States and about the military situation. And though I'm going to start this programme by discussing the diplomacy, the first part of this programme will be about the diplomacy. It is the military situation that is the more important, because it is absolutely clear to me that it is the military situation that is driving the diplomacy. And this has never been clearer or more starkly obvious than now. I will anticipate by saying that President Putin of Russia yesterday attended the command post of Army Group West, somewhere in Ukraine, and received a briefing there. And that briefing confirmed that the military situation on the front lines for Ukraine is even more critical than had previously been imagined. Now, this explains the diplomacy. I am sure that the United States now has a reasonably clear picture of how bad the military situation on the Ukrainian front lines has become. Throughout the summer and early autumn, the President of the United States was being provided with false information by President Zelensky of Ukraine, by various members of his own administration, by General Kellogg, for example, who was taking his information mostly from President Zelensky. There was a briefing which the president apparently attended in September, I seem to recall, which was attended by the Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz, the US ambassador to the United Nations, and of course by Kellogg. And they all sought to persuade the president, Donald Trump, that the situation on the front lines in Ukraine was actually not so bad, that the Ukrainians were holding their own, that the Russians were bogged down, that their offensive was not moving forward, that the Ukrainians were inflicting multiple times greater losses on the Russians than they themselves were suffering. And of course, that narrative was all over the media, and it was being pushed by all sorts of people, including some people who should know better. And it had become, for a time, I think, almost the consensus in the West. And the president himself apparently did have some doubts, but he published an extraordinary comment on Truth Social, ironic in some terms, in which he said that he'd now finally understood that Ukraine is actually winning the war, that the Russians were not advancing, that this is an extraordinarily bad look for Russia, and, well, it was the Russians who were making the huge mistakes by not therefore agreeing to end the war, what he repeatedly and wrongly calls the pointless war, when he was telling them to. So that was the narrative, that was the view that was circulating, and which all the indications suggest was accepted by the president, by Donald Trump himself. And then something dramatic happened, and we can identify, I think, fairly precisely what that dramatic event was. On the 25th of October, 3 weeks ago, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, had a meeting at the headquarters of Group of Forces Center in Ukraine. My own view is that this took place in the town of Selidovo, but that's just my guess. He was briefed by the chief of the general staff, General Gerasimov, and he received further briefings. And the Russians announced that two groupings of Ukrainian troops, numbering several thousand men, had been encircled by the Russians in two critically important towns. One was Pokrovsk and the other was Kupiansk. And obviously, the president and his officials were briefed in the United States, in Washington, about that announcement from Russia. And this is the moment, almost exactly, when the renewed diplomatic effort, the one led by Steve Witkoff, began. And you can see this because I think it was in the Financial Times, or certainly it was somewhere in the media yesterday. I read that Witkoff began work on the new Trump peace plan 3 weeks ago. And 3 weeks ago takes us exactly to this event, this meeting between Putin and his generals on the 25th of October. It suddenly dawned on the United States that far from Ukraine holding its own, it is losing the war, and that its ability to sustain the war for much longer might be coming to an end. And what we are now seeing in the diplomacy is a frantic attempt to get the Russians to stop before the collapse comes. The result has been a peace plan that has been worked on, which does indeed go significantly further than General Kellogg's freezing of the conflict proposal, as we will see, and which contains various choice items which are supposed to be tempting, to tempt the Russians. But the intention clearly is to prevent the coming collapse of the Ukrainian army in Donbass and ultimately across the front lines. It's that moment of awakening in Washington which has led to the frantic activity over the last 3 weeks, which we are now seeing. Now, I say all of that, I should say in advance that the Russians are now making it absolutely clear that they are deeply sceptical about the proposals that are coming out of Washington. And in fact, this morning, one Russian military expert, Alexei Leonkov, who has given an interview for the Russian official media, he has been quoted as saying that Kupiansk was part, Kupiansk, which, as we will see, has now fallen, was part of a chain of fortress cities, urban centres that were meant to be held by Ukrainian forces at all costs. Once these forces fall, nothing will stop the Russian army's advance, and the Ukrainian troops will find themselves unable to resist. We are winning. This is a direct quote from Leonkov. We are winning and we will not surrender our victory to anyone. And as we will see later in this program, there have been similar comments from no less a person than President Putin himself, which have been phrased in implacable terms. Now, that now then brings me to the American proposal. And I'm going to say, first of all, that there has been publication by a Ukrainian MP, a very, very well-known and important Ukrainian MP, Goncharenko, who has been a continuous and very, very public commentator about events in Ukraine, and who is by no means, by the way, a Zelensky loyalist. He has on many occasions been very critical of Zelensky. Anyway, there's been publication by Goncharenko of what he claims is the plan. And this plan has been circulated in many places by the Ukrainian magazine, a news magazine, Strana, but it's also appeared in the Russian media, in the Western media as well. And I'm going to say straight away that the document that Goncharenko has published, which clearly comes from Ukrainian sources, it is in fact, what he's actually published is a photograph of some kind of electronic document. Anyway, it differs very significantly indeed from the reports about the Trump peace plan, if I'm going to call it that, which have been circulating in the American media recently, the reports that appeared in Axios and in the Financial Times. In fact, some of the differences are very, very sharp. And that can only be explained by one of two things. Either someone is engaging in a great deal of spinning, trying to suggest that the peace plan is different from what it really is, and perhaps trying to deceive and mislead the Russians in that way, or, which I still think more likely, this so-called plan is still a work in progress. There is perhaps a single document that is being worked on with input from various parties, including on the Russian side from Kirill Dmitriev. But there are various different alternatives and various clauses to this plan, and that it's these, there are these different variants of these, of this plan, which are being presented to various people. Now, I say that because, as I said, there are sharp differences between what I will call the Goncharenko publication and the Axios publication. Now, to give two obvious and very glaring examples, the Axios and Financial Times commentaries spoke about Russian being made a state language of Ukraine, and the Orthodox Church in Ukraine being reinstated. There is nothing in the Goncharenko proposal that says anything of the kind. The closest it comes to is a provision which says that Ukraine will adopt EU rules on religious tolerance and the protection of linguistic minorities, and that both countries will agree to abolish all discriminatory measures and guarantee the rights of Ukrainian and Russian media and education. Now, that falls well below, far below, the earlier claims that Russian was going to be given official status, and that the Ukrainian, that the Orthodox Church was going to be re-established. So that is not there in the Goncharenko document. The Goncharenko document also says other things which are again different from some of the earlier reports that we had been reading. For example, there is nothing that remotely approximates to a report in the Daily Telegraph that the Ukrainians would withdraw from eastern Donbass and the Russians would occupy Donbass but would repay some kind of rent to Ukraine for their occupation. That was an absurd idea. It is not to be found in this document either. Then there were claims that, as part of the proposals, Ukraine was going to cut its army in half, its military in half, and others said by 2.5 times. And I said that if it was indeed 2.5 times, then that would suggest a Ukrainian military, at least a frontline military, that along of approximately 50,000 men. And there were also reports that Ukraine would give up all of its long-range weapons, its missile systems, and presumably its drones that would be able to strike targets inside Russia and possibly Moscow and St. Petersburg. Well, there is nothing in this proposal about Ukraine giving up long-range weapons, and there is the only thing this proposal says about the Ukrainian military is that the Ukrainian military is capped at a level of 600,000. Now, that is not a small army, that is a very big army. As it happens, I believe that it is a bigger army than the one Ukraine has at the moment. So that is not going to be a proposal which is acceptable to the Russians, or is at least consistent with what the Russians have been demanding. And of course, it is different again from the various claims about these proposals that have been circulating. Now, there have been other proposals as well, other reports as well, reports that have been appearing that foreign troops would not be permitted on Ukrainian territory, and that diplomatic flights would not be allowed to Kiev. Well, there's nothing in this document, the Goncharenko document, about diplomatic flights. And the document about foreign troop deployments, what it says is this: NATO agrees not to station troops in Ukraine. Now, that is not the same as saying that foreign troops will not be stationed in Ukraine. It suggests that NATO, as an alliance, will not station troops in Ukraine. But, of course, it is open for countries that are members of NATO, Britain and France, for example, to station troops in Ukraine and to do so outside the NATO umbrella. And indeed, as I am making this program, the British government, Keir Starmer's government, is saying that it is intending still to do precisely that. Now, that is something which the Russians, of course, strongly object to, and we see that actually Contrary to earlier reports, the Goncharenko document appears to provide for it. And then there's been actual changes or variations to this document since Goncharenko published it. So there was a report that European fighter jets will be stationed in Poland. Well, they actually already are. I understand that has since been changed to NATO fighter jets will be stationed in Poland. Well, that of course is true. They already are, but the insinuation is that they will be used to operate in defense of Ukraine in some future emergency. And then we were told the provisions, the Goncharenko document says that the provisions would allow NATO to intervene militarily in Ukraine in the event that the Russians broke the provisions of this agreement, presumably using these fighter jets. It seems unclear whether this is connected to the security guarantees that are mentioned in another part of this document. But then, after this document was published, reports appeared in the US media which said that the security guarantees for Ukraine would last for just 10 years. So not an open-ended commitment by the United States to defend Ukraine. And then there are other things in this document which are extremely bizarre. For example, the document says that once the agreement is reached, there will be a staged process whereby Russia is readmitted to the global economy. That is, by the way, an astonishing statement, because of course Russia remains a part of the global economy. It has been sanctioned and it is not able to trade freely with the West, but as we know, it is trading with many, many other countries. But anyway, that Russia will be readmitted to the global economy, that there will be a staged and gradual removal of sanctions. The Russians are not going to believe that. But then the reward that Russia will eventually be given is that it will be readmitted to the G7, which will again become the G8. Except, of course, that the Russians have repeatedly said, and have been saying ever since Donald Trump was first elected President of the United States and became President of the United States for the first time in 2017, that they are not interested in rejoining the G7 and the G8, that they have no desire to be a part of this organization again. I don't know how many times the Russians have made this point to Trump directly, to the Americans, but it's as if Trump simply cannot bring himself to believe that. He still seems to think that the Russians want a seat on the Western table, even though they have repeatedly explained to him that they don't. Anyway, there are other provisions in this agreement too that actually are not entirely clear. So the Ukrainians are supposed to withdraw from Donbass, and the Russians presumably then are to occupy Donbass. But the area of Donbass which the Ukrainians are vacating is supposed to be demilitarized. Again, it's difficult to imagine the Russians agreeing to something like that, especially when the Ukrainians retain a 600,000 troop army, just to say. Then the document says that the United States and other countries, though not necessarily Ukraine, will recognize Russia as de facto in control of Crimea and Donbass. But what does that actually mean? What is the difference between recognizing de facto control or de jure, in other words, legal control? Now, one can come up with explanations. For example, you might say that de facto control, whilst in some way continuing to acknowledge Ukrainian sovereignty over Donbass, means that the United States would nonetheless recognize the Russian passports of people in Donbass, enabling people in Donbass to travel to the United States on Russian passports. For example, I mean, you can make that distinction, but it is not spelled out in this document. Then, a point which several people have made. The document says that once the agreement is reached, it is legally binding on both sides, and it also says that the territorial arrangements cannot be changed by force. Now, what does making an agreement legally binding, an agreement of this kind legally binding, actually mean? If parties to a conflict enter into an agreement with each other, is it not automatically binding on the parties? It's perhaps worth pointing out at this point that the people who have been working on this document, people like Witkoff and, by some reports, Jared Kushner, come from the world of business. They are businessmen, which is what, of course, Donald Trump is. And business people will often reach agreements, and they will say in the agreement that the agreement is legally binding on the parties. And quite commonly, the agreement will then say which operative law, say the law of the United States or the law of the state of California or of New York or whatever, is the relevant law under which this document will be construed, and it will also identify the courts or the arbitration agencies that will make the agreement legally enforceable and binding. And I can't help but think that these businessmen who have been working on this document have carried over that concept into this document, which is why we have this strange provision about this particular document, which is obviously going to be an interstate agreement that it is legally binding. But what does that actually mean? Legally binding in what sense? Who is going to enforce it? After all, legally binding documents in commercial law are enforced by courts, but treaties are not enforced in the same way. Is it being suggested here, for example, that this document should be enshrined in a formal treaty? Will there be a resolution of the UN Security Council, which will then convert it into a document of international law? But then interstate agreements always are part of international law anyway. And if we're talking about using a resolution of the Security Council to make something legally binding, well, the Minsk Agreement of 2015 was enshrined in a resolution, a binding resolution of the UN Security Council. And nobody seems to worry about that. And the Ukrainians, as they openly admit, basically chose to ignore the Minsk Agreement. But then we come to the further point, and it's one that's been made to me by several people, by the way, in emails. If Russian control of territory is de facto, as set out in that agreement, then how is that consistent with that control of that territory being provided for in a document that is legally binding, given that de jure effectively means that something is legal. Presumably, de facto control means something that is both legal and less than legal at one and the same time. Again, it is all very strange. There are other aspects to this agreement which are extremely strange. For example, there is a very complicated provisions about the situation with the Russian frozen assets. Now, as far as the Russians are concerned, these are their assets and they should be paid back to them. The Russians have said that repeatedly and continuously and all the time. This agreement, however, comes up with a rather different proposal, which is that most of the assets, two-thirds of them, will be paid back to the Russians, but the remaining third, will be used to rebuild Ukraine. Now, that could be construed as Russia agreeing to pay Ukraine reparations. As it stands, I can't imagine that this particular agreement, this particular provision, is going to be acceptable to the Russians. As part of a negotiation between the Russians and the Ukrainians and the Americans, I have myself floated the possibility that the Russians might agree to contribute to the reconstruction of a friendly Ukraine, and they might be prepared to use some of the money from their assets to do that. But I cannot imagine that they would agree to do it in this stark way. They might say, look, we are prepared to contribute $75 billion to help reconstruct Ukraine, but that would be our decision based upon our ownership of what are our own assets. I cannot imagine that the Russians would agree to the provision as it is set out here. There's an awful lot also in the agreement about other things. So the agreement at one place, in one place, makes some really quite astonishing suggestion that the Russians and the Americans agree to arms control. The United States and Russia will agree to extend the validity of treaties on the non-proliferation and control of nuclear weapons, including the START 1 treaty. This is all rather strange because Russia has never in any place or at any time suggested that it is thinking of pulling out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968. So why would Russia agree to the validity of that treaty precisely? And as for including the START 1 treaty, presumably this is connected to the Russian proposal to extend the new START treaty, which is due to expire in February. But just to say, I don't think that a provision of that kind about nuclear arms control and arms limitation between the superpowers should be contained in a document of this kind to settle what is in effect a regional conflict. It makes absolutely no sense. It, in fact, dangerously trivializes the issue. Just saying. Now, there's also other things about discussions about security, the United States and Russia entering into wider discussions about security, which is all well and good. But again, I don't think that that really belongs in an agreement of this kind. There is, however, something which for the Russians is important, which is that the agreement specifically says that Ukraine will not join NATO, that Ukraine is required to change its constitution to reflect that fact, that NATO states, other NATO states, will somehow agree to that taking place, that there will be no membership of NATO for Ukraine, and then the agreement also makes some really extraordinary proposals that NATO expansion ends. Ukraine agrees to enshrine in its constitution that it will not join NATO, and NATO agrees to include in its statutes a provision that Ukraine will not be admitted in the future. And as I said, the agreement also elsewhere says that there will be no further extension of NATO. So that is important, and it is something obviously that the Russians will want to see work through. But again, the way it's put together, is it something that the Russians can rely upon? And by the way, I've noticed that in some versions of this document that are now circulating, the provision about the non-extension of NATO apparently no longer appears. So again, there's a great deal here that makes very little sense. And I can't imagine that this is going to be fully acceptable to the Russians, and they will probably almost certainly want it to be fleshed out in detail. And as for Zaporozhye and Kherson region, I have pointed out already that the Russians have already made it clear, or have previously made it clear, that the Russians eventually expect the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions will be transferred to them in their entirety. The provision, however, says, the agreement, the Goncharenko draft, however, says, Kherson and Zaporozhye will be frozen along the line of contact, which will mean de facto recognition along the line of contact. But elsewhere, the provision says is that after agreeing on future territorial arrangements, both the Russia and Ukraine undertake not to change these arrangements by force, which appears to imply that at some point in the future, following negotiations, Zaporozhye and Kherson will indeed be transferred to Russia. Except, of course, the language is, to put it mildly, ambiguous, and hardly such as to satisfy the Russians. So an incredibly confusing document, one which is inconsistent with much of the earlier briefing, and one which I have to say straight away has about it very much of an amateur look. It really doesn't seem to me as if it has been properly thought through or worked out. And that is exactly what you would expect of a document worked on in a rush, in a state of panic, as the front lines in Ukraine start to crumble, by people like Witkoff, Kushner, and perhaps even Trump himself, and indeed Rubio, who are not professional negotiators. Now, there are things in this document which the Russians certainly would be willing to work with. The issue of NATO membership, non-NATO membership for Ukraine, appears to be conceded, at least by the United States. Russian control of Donbass and Crimea is conceded as well. there are still the question marks about Zaporozhye and Kherson region, but it might be possible to talk and come to agreements about that also. There are some hints that something might be done to address the concerns of Russian speakers in the rest of Ukraine. This is a document that could be used as a base for negotiations. But the United States is not treating it in that way. Now, one thing that has happened over the last couple of hours is that apparently yesterday, Dan Driscoll, the US Assistant Secretary of State, and the US Army Chief of Staff, presented this document, presumably the Goncharenko document, to Zelensky and asked Zelensky to agree. And the reports say that Zelensky was given up until the 27th of November to agree to this document, to sign this document. And there are reports in the British media today that the United States has told Zelensky that if he does not sign this document on by the 27th of November, then the United States will stop providing Ukraine with intelligence and will prevent all further arms deliveries to Ukraine. So that suggests that the United States is trying to strong-arm Zelensky into accepting this document. Zelensky is very unhappy about this. He has made it fairly clear that he doesn't like this document. The Europeans have also said that they don't like this document either. They don't like the provisions in this document about NATO and about the surrender of territory, and they don't like conceding the principle of a cap being placed on the Ukrainian armed forces. Since those earlier reports in the media, a Ukrainian official has come forward and has spoken about this document, and he has said that Ukraine will not cross any red lines. And this has been said by Kristina Gajovishin. She confirms that the document has been received, but Ukraine is ready, and that Ukraine is ready for substantive negotiations. But she went on to say that Ukraine's red lines are clear and unchangeable. There will never be recognition, formal or otherwise, of Ukrainian territory temporarily occupied by Russia. Ukrainian territory supposedly is not for sale. Ukraine will not accept any restrictions on its rights to self-defense or on the size and capabilities of its armed forces. It will not tolerate any encroachments on its sovereignty, a sovereign right to choose the alliances it wants to join. So this appears to be a semi-official Ukrainian response made by Ukraine's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations. In effect, this is a rejection of this document. And we see that the Europeans are increasingly saying that they reject it too. So, nonetheless, the United States wants Zelensky to sign off and is threatening him, is making threats to cut off intelligence assistance and further military aid if he does not. And the United States is also making threats against Russia. The US's ambassador to the United Nations, Mike Waltz, who is, of course, for a time, Donald Trump's national security advisor, is now saying that if the Russians don't agree to all of this, they will face further sanctions. Though what these sanctions can be, given that the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio himself said just a few days ago that the United States has now sanctioned pretty much everything in Russia that can be sanctioned. Anyway, none of that is clear. So, to me, a lot of this reminds me, and I have to say this, of what happened some months ago. Back in March, the United States at that time was pursuing the freeze of the conflict idea, the ceasefire idea. They strong-armed Zelensky into agreeing to it. He didn't want to agree to it. They threatened to cut off intelligence assistance and military supplies unless he agreed. They got Yermak and other Ukrainian officials. They isolated them in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And they applied the third degree and they got the Ukrainians to accept a ceasefire, which Zelensky very, very grudgingly also then accepted. But then, of course, it all fell apart when it was presented to the Russians. And I can't help but think that something very similar is happening. The United States is now desperate to stop the Russians, to get the Russians to stop. It's put together this bizarre smorgasbord of a proposal, giving the Russians something, giving the Europeans something, giving even the Ukrainians a few things. But none of it is really very coherent and or makes a great deal of sense. But it's all intended to get the Russians to stop. In order to get the Russians to stop, you've got to get the Ukrainians first to agree. So again, the third degree is being applied to the Ukrainians to get them to stop. They, by the way, are loudly complaining that the pressure that has been put on them is similar to the pressure they were under previously to agree the mineral rights, the mineral extractions deal. Remember that? We don't hear much about that anymore. But anyway, the Americans put titanic pressure on the Ukrainians to agree to that at one time. And the Ukrainians, by the way, are also complaining that their friends in Europe are not speaking up loudly enough to support Ukraine against all of this pressure. That the Ukrainians, as they've said, as they've indicated, don't want to be pushed into agreeing to any of this by the United States. Now, that then brings us back to the Russians, because, of course, the narrative that we have been hearing, or at least the story that the media has been circulating over the last couple of days, is that this has been a plan that has been worked on by Witkoff and Dmitriev together. Now, the Russians have now formally disputed this. This was said by Peskov this morning. He said that we haven't received anything officially. We see some innovations, but officially we haven't received anything. And there hasn't been any substantive discussion of any of these items. The Russians are also saying that as far as they're concerned, the only proposals that they have discussed with the Americans are the ones that Putin and Trump agreed when they met in Anchorage in Alaska. And the Russians have made it very clear that those are the only proposals that they are prepared to discuss. And I gather that this was also said by Peskov, and it has been said over the last few hours by other Russian officials. And of course, that is consistent with what the Russian Foreign Ministry has been saying, which has also been saying that they have not been involved in the creation of this document. And they are mystified by the various proposals that are circulating, suggesting that they have. So what exactly has been going on? Well, I suspect that what has happened is that Witkoff and Kushner have indeed spoken to Dmitriev, and that Dmitriev has indeed had some input into some of this. We see, for example, that the provisions about NATO, no NATO expansion and all of that were there. There is some, however, evidence that the Americans have also been speaking to the Ukrainians. Rustem Umerov, the Secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council, who's been moving around the world, did indeed apparently go to the United States. He met with US officials there, including Witkoff, probably. However, he is denying that he had any role in changing any part of this proposal. There are reports circulating that the original draft contained strong provisions about investigating corruption in Ukraine, and that Umerov managed to have that taken out of this agreement. Umerov, however, is now denying this. Anyway, it's likely that there has been some input also. Now, this is as it should be. If you are trying to negotiate with various parties, then you need to have some understanding of what their various opinions are. So it's absolutely correct that the United States should be contacting the Russians, someone like Dmitriev, and the Ukrainians, someone like Umerov, to find out what each side is thinking. Rubio has just said that the United States has been doing precisely that. But I think it is now clear, at least from the Goncharenko document, that the Americans, to the extent that they've been listening to the Russians, have only been listening to what they want to hear rather than working fully with every point that the Russians are making. I am sure, in fact, I have no doubt at all, that not only does the Goncharenko document not reflect, represent substantive Russian input, but that it already also falls very far short of what the Americans and the Russians, Putin and Trump, appeared to agree with each other in Anchorage. And given that the Russians have repeatedly said that Anchorage must be the starting point of any discussions, even if the Americans are able to strong arm the Ukrainians into accepting this, and that's far from guaranteed, with the Europeans doing everything they possibly can to push back on all of this. But even if the Americans are able to strong arm the Ukrainians into signing this document, it's going to fall apart the moment it is presented to the Russians. The Russians will say, as it stands, this is not an agreement. This is not a complete agreement. It is a basis for discussion. But there has to be a substantive negotiation looking at all of this. We cannot simply walk away with the agreement as it stands at the moment, because it is too vague and ultimately it promises nothing. And there's been a comment to this effect by the Russian news agency TASS. It says this: the document published by Alexei Goncharenko on his Telegram channel contains a number of provisions that have already been published by the Western media, including a cap on the number of Ukrainian troops. The exact figure has not been determined, but is supposed to be in the final document. Well, as we see, it's now been changed, and we're told that 600,000. The report then goes on to say, NATO agrees not to deploy troops in Ukraine. Ukraine gets security guarantees from the US, although the details were not specified. Ukraine's neutral status is sealed by the Constitution, and NATO agrees not to undertake Ukraine. The document has provisions about Russia, but the majority of the plan's provisions come in the form of general principles, this is what the Russians are saying, that lack concrete details. A so-called Council of Peace, led by US President Trump, will be in charge of their implementation. You can see the sarcasm, the irony that is dripping from this comment. It's too vague. It doesn't make sense. It's all general principles. Anything like this is almost guaranteed to fall apart, and it doesn't come anywhere close to meeting Russian conditions. It can be used as a basis for discussions, but it cannot be accepted as a final settlement agreement in this form. Now, here I'm going to come back to a point which I have been belaboring in comment after comment, going all the way back to Trump's inauguration, which is that the administration is not conducting negotiations in a proper way. Proper negotiations with the Russians require proper, well-organized negotiating teams, meeting in plenary sessions on a regular basis with a structured system of back channels between the negotiators and between the senior officials in Moscow and Washington to move the process forward. The plenary sessions are essential because it is over the course of these that the positions of each side on individual points are made clear and known to each other, and that the points of difference are narrowed and identified, so that through the back channels, means can be found to settle them or to find ways round them. That is how the Soviet Union and the United States conducted negotiations with each other during the Cold War. Perhaps the best example of this are the SALT I negotiations, which were conducted in exactly that way, and the administration could usefully go back to inform itself about how those negotiations were conducted and see how it was done and how it worked. Now, the Russians have repeatedly tried to get the Americans to understand this ever since Trump became president. In their very first conversation after Trump became president, telephone conversation, Putin actually tried to get Trump to agree to set up proper negotiating teams, as I remember. And there have been abortive attempts to set up negotiating teams as well. There were a whole series of meetings in Turkey to sort out the issues relating to the embassies and other issues of normalizing relations between the United States and Russia. But the officials chosen for those negotiations were not remotely senior enough to run that kind of negotiation properly. There was an attempt to negotiate an agreement, a ceasefire in the Black Sea, a return to the grain deal, the original 2022 grain deal. And the Russians put together a very strong negotiating team and appointed a senior negotiator, Grigory Karasin, to head their delegation. And the Russians appear to have hoped, I discussed it at the time, that this discussion about the grain deal would then expand and involve direct negotiations between the Russians and the Americans on the whole Ukraine issue, except the negotiation, the two teams, the American team was much weaker, met once, no agreement, no substantive agreements were reached. Well, some agreements did appear to be reached, but they were not acceptable to the White House, and the whole thing again ran out of steam. And then a few weeks ago, the Russians proposed that the negotiations in Istanbul between themselves and the Ukrainians be upgraded. They suggested that three working parties be created and that more senior people be appointed to head the negotiating teams. The Western powers, the Europeans in particular, have repeatedly complained about what they say is the low status of the Russian chief negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, who is, however, must be said, an aide of President Putin's. But the Russians offered to upgrade their negotiating team to appoint a more senior person, and the Europeans, who had been complaining about the low status of Medinsky, then fell silent. They said nothing. They made no proposal to upgrade the Ukrainian negotiating team, and nor, of course, the Ukrainians, who've also up to now complained about Medinsky's low status. Nor have they agreed to the working parties that the Russians proposed, and nor have various hints from the Russians that they would like the Americans to appoint a proper negotiating team to participate in the negotiation in Istanbul. None of that has been taken up. So the result is that we have this amateur proposal. When I say amateur, I mean, I don't mean any, I'm not being overly critical of Witkoff and Kushner. They're doing the best they can, but they simply don't have the experience of this, and they don't have the experience of negotiating at this level with the Russians. So we have this bizarre negotiation cobbled together in a hurry, carried out by two very well-intentioned, I've no doubt, very gifted, very intelligent amateurs who are putting together all the various things that they think one party is going to like and the other party is going to like, and they're hoping that this will somehow make it acceptable and that it will all stick. And they don't understand at all that on a conflict like this, with a party like the Russians, doing it in that way simply isn't going to work. Now, the Russians, of course, know all about this. And the most important Russian of all has now spoken. Now, Putin visited the headquarters of a Group of Forces West. He received a briefing from the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, who is, of course, the senior Russian military officer and the overall commander of the Russian forces engaged in the special military operation. And he also received briefings from two other senior Russian military commanders as well. And I will come to all of that in a moment. But over the course of that meeting, Putin had this to say. Let's be clear about the nature of the Ukrainian political leadership. Since March 2024, which is when Zelensky's electoral term expired, it has ceased to be a legitimate government. It is a group of individuals, a criminal organisation that has usurped power under the pretext of continuing the war with Russia and is now clinging to it for personal enrichment. This is now a matter of public record, confirmed by an anti-corruption investigation within Ukraine itself. It should be obvious to everyone, notice those words, obvious to everyone, Donald Trump, Witkoff, the Americans, the Europeans, but of course here he is addressing the Americans. It should be obvious to everyone that these people sitting on their golden thrones, I'm taking this from the Kremlin's website, their transcript of what he said. In fact, he didn't say golden thrones. He used a much cruder word. He did not say thrones. But anyway, sitting on their golden thrones are hardly thinking about the future of their country, the ordinary citizens of Ukraine, their officer corps, or especially their common soldiers. No, they have other priorities. But we have our objectives and our own agenda. Our principal goal remains the unconditional achievement of the special military operations aims and the fulfillment of our duties, of the duties our fatherland and the people of Russia have entrusted to us. The people of Russia are counting on us. And then he addresses the military. They are counting on you, and they expect the results our country is. Let us get to work. Mr. Gerasimov, you have the floor. Now, that is implacable. It is saying that there is no government in Kiev. This is a criminal organization that is there to enrich itself. That essentially says that there has to be regime change in Kiev, because how can you negotiate and come to agreements with criminals? And it also says that the principal goal remains the unconditional achievement of the special military operations aims. And that those words must be addressed to the United States, that the Russians have set out their terms. They set it out in Putin's speech on the 14th of June 2024, Istanbul Plus. The Russians, Lavrov, have essentially said that Trump and Witkoff agreed to all of that when they met in Anchorage in Alaska. Nothing less will do. All of these strange ideas appearing in this document, all those provisions about a Ukrainian army of 600,000 men and of only NATO troops entering Ukraine and all of that is unacceptable. It must be based on what was agreed in Alaska, and that's final. So I don't expect the Russians to change their stance. I think the threats of sanctions are not going to impress them. Why should they impress them? If the Americans are prepared to come to the Russians and say, look, this is a basis for discussion, then the Russians will discuss this. And then we can have a proper negotiation and we can work forward with this. But if the Americans come along and say to the Russians, this is something that Zelensky has agreed to, this is a take it or leave it document, then the Russians will say no, just as they said no to the ceasefire, the unconditional ceasefire, freezing of the conflict idea which the Americans presented to them back in the spring after they had strong-armed Zelensky to accept that. Anyway, that's my understanding of the political situation and of the diplomacy. Now, just to say again, we are clearly now in a race. The Americans are trying to catch up with events on the ground. They were asleep on the wheel throughout the summer and the autumn, thinking that there was plenty of time and that the Ukrainians were holding their own. They've now realised that that is not the case. So they are, it is the Americans now who are under extreme pressure because the military situation in Ukraine is rapidly changing and the Ukrainian positions are collapsing. Now, let's now turn to what Gerasimov and the military officers told Putin. The first thing they told Putin is that Kupiansk has fallen. I've already said this previously. I'd already come to that view myself based on the various reports that the Russian Ministry of Defense was giving. The Russians have now provided video footage showing their soldiers all over Kupiansk, this extremely strong fortified position, this fortified city has fallen. It is now under Russian control. The Russian commander whose forces have captured Kupiansk now also says that his forces are advancing, have broken into Liman, and that fighting is going on there, and that the village of Yampol near Liman has been captured fully by the Russians as well. Now, there is now finally video footage which confirms that the Russian troops are indeed fighting inside Liman. And in fact, the situation seems to be rapidly developing in Liman. The situation in Liman seems to be, well, the Russian commander seemed to think that Liman would fall very quickly. Now, the most interesting thing that this commander said, the thing that really stood out for me, was that he spoke about the fighting in this area being focused on the Izium direction. So that essentially confirms that after Liman has been captured, the Russians are going to advance to try to capture Izium as well. Izium, an important town to the south of Liman, the south of Kupiansk, which is, as I said, has now fallen, and to the north of Slavyansk. The Russians will soon be in control of Liman, and as we will see in a moment, they will soon be in control of Siversk as well. Slavyansk, the northern town in the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation, is being encircled. And that is happening rapidly. The other Russian commander, in some respects, gave even more dramatic news. He said he's in charge of the Russian forces tasked with capturing Konstantinovka, the town located to the east of Pokrovsk. It's a bigger place than Pokrovsk. He said that his forces have broken into the southern and eastern sections of Pokrovsk. They've reached, of Konstantinovka. They reached the center of Konstantinovka. They've captured 4,000 buildings in Konstantinovka. And he indicated that he expects his forces to be in overall control of Konstantinivka by mid-December. That is his objective. And he's also tasked, his forces are also tasked with the capture of Siversk. And he gave a very interesting account of the fighting in Siversk. He says that our main actions are taking place on the northeastern and southern outskirts. We continue the encirclement and blockade of the town. And he spoke about the Ukrainian troops in Siversk, that the situation there is that the Ukrainian forces there are being basically cut to pieces, that they're taking positions in Siversk rapidly. In Siversk itself, operations are underway to clear residential areas of Ukrainian armed formations. The way he spoke, my impression is that he expects Siversk to fall, the town that Julian Röpke, the German journalist, has said represents the strongest position of the Ukrainian army in Donbass. I'm not sure whether that's true, by the way. But anyway, this Russian commander expects Siversk to fall, clearly expects to fall, within the next few days. So Siversk, Kupiansk has fallen. Siversk likely to fall very soon. Liman likely to fall very soon. Putin claimed that up to 15 battalions of Ukrainian troops have been surrounded in the fields east of Kupiansk on the east bank of the Oskol River. If all of those battalions were up to strength, that would be about 7,500 men. Obviously, it is in reality only a fraction of that. But anyway, clearly a military disaster being faced by Ukraine in northern Donbass. Now, the commander of the Russian forces near Pokrovsk was not present because the fighting there remains very intense. But there's been a cascade of reports from Pokrovsk. Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff, said that the Russians now control 75% of Pokrovsk, which, by the way, is significantly less than virtually all of the mapping projects have suggested up to now. I believe that what Gerasimov means is that there are still many pockets of Ukrainian resistance inside Pokrovsk, and that has been widely acknowledged. But yesterday, the Russians produced film footage from the Shakhtarsky micro-district, the big built-up high-rise area of Pokrovsk. That is clearly securely under Russian control. Russian troops were moving around it. There was no sound or appearance of fighting. It's clear that the heart of Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk has collapsed. In Mirnograd, the situation for the Ukrainians continues to deteriorate rapidly as well. And I have this group of commanders did not really discuss at length the situation in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk region. Gerasimov touched on this briefly. He said that the Vostok group of forces continues to expand its control in the Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye region, advancing westwards to bypass the enemy's main defences. Since November 1st, this push has liberated over 230 square kilometres and 13 communities, and forward subunits of this group have already reached the Gaichur River and continue to advance. Dnieper group of forces, this is in the western Zaporozhye area, have captured Malaya Tokmachka and are engaged in combat to secure Primorskoye and Stepnogorsk. In addition to the ground offensive, we are continuing a campaign of targeted retaliatory strikes against key facilities of Ukraine's defense industry and its supporting energy infrastructure. Notice that Gerasimov here is not just indulging in the fiction that these are strikes intended to counter or to respond to Ukrainian attacks on the Russian energy system. Anyway, the point is, the Russians have reached the center of Konstantinivka. The encirclement of the Ukrainian forces in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd continues and grows ever tighter. Kupiansk has now fallen. It's the first of the towns to fall. Siversk is about to fall, might even fall within the next 24 hours, and I think that is entirely plausible. Liman, perhaps a little behind, but not much. A military catastrophe is progressing rapidly in Donbass. At some point, probably, the Russians are going to be presented by this proposal by the Americans. The Russians will say the proposal doesn't go anywhere far enough. It does not address their concerns. It is not the proposal that appeared to have been agreed by the Americans and the Russians in Anchorage. It falls short of that. And the Americans are trying to move the dial as fast as they can because of the military crisis in Donbass. They are in a race to get a deal done to stop the fighting before the Ukrainian army in Donbass collapses. But based on what the Russian military told Putin yesterday, all the indications are that the Americans have left it too late. If the Americans had come up with something like this kind of proposal, the proposal that we're now reading, back in the spring, there would have been ample time to move forward with it and to discuss and agree a diplomatic way forward. By now, the Russians sense that victory is theirs. Just to repeat again what Leonkov said, we are winning and we will not surrender our victory to anyone. And that he also said that the Ukrainian battle lines may collapse at any moment, and that the upcoming winter campaign is going to be a total disaster for Ukraine. And of course, Putin has hardened his position. He says that the Ukrainian government is a criminal organization, and he's making it fairly clear, by the way, that he thinks that it should be changed. And in the meantime, he's telling Gerasimov, we've got a job to do. The job is to achieve the objectives of the military operation, the special military operation. It doesn't seem to me as if Putin is in any mood to compromise, and certainly he's not in any mood to simply accept as a fait accompli a proposal like this. So there we are. That's my assessment of the situation as of now. We will see what happens next. We will see what happens if the Ukrainians stick to their position that they're not accepting these proposals. We will see what the Europeans do. But as I said, even if the Ukrainians are strong-armed into signalling some kind of acceptance of these proposals, which I, by the way, think extremely unlikely, I think that the Russians, if they're presented with them as a take-it-or-leave-it deal, will simply say, well, in that case, we leave it. Anyway, that's me for today. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also our new Substack site. Please also remember, if you want to support our work, to do so via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please do remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this platform, to this channel rather. And last but not least, to remind you again that I will be in Edinburgh. I'll be travelling to Edinburgh tomorrow, though I expect to do one further video from London early in the morning before I go. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.